Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, December 17, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call on public defenders and client choice. My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome two experts, but to introduce them, I'm going to first introduce our moderator. Tim Lynch is the director of the Project on Criminal Justice at the Cato Institute. Tim's going to moderate the call today. Without any further ado, Tim, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Christian, and thanks to the Federalist Society for hosting this discussion. I'm going to take just a minute or two to set up today's conversation by providing some background information on our subject. I'll then go over the format and introduce our guests. Our topic today is indigent criminal defense, and we should probably start this conversation off by noting the landmark Supreme Court case of Gideon versus Wainwright, which was decided in 1963. In that case, the Supreme Court ruled that poor people who are accused of a serious crime are entitled to a lawyer that would be paid for by the government. I think we've all seen countless television scenes over the years where the police are placing some guy under arrest, and one of the Miranda warnings says something like, "You have the right to an attorney. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be appointed for you by the court." That's a reference to the Gideon versus Wainwright precedent. Now, here's the thing. The Supreme Court in that case did not say how these lawyers would be chosen or how they would be paid exactly or how we would make sure that these lawyers would provide an adequate and professional defense to their clients. The most common model that has arisen, the one that I think most people are familiar with, is the Office of the Public Defender. But there are other models as well. In some jurisdictions, judges will assign attorneys to particular defendants. Today, we're going to discuss another approach to indigent criminal defense, a model that has not yet been tried in the United States. You might call this model a system of defense vouchers. And the idea is very similar to the school voucher concept. Instead of a public defender monopoly, the indigent person would have the option of accepting a voucher and then hiring an attorney of his own choice to represent him in court. I think we should remember that there is already a market for criminal defense services, but right now it only functions for middle class and affluent defendants who have the ability to retain their own counsel. A voucher system would introduce free market principles to the indigent area. And what's very interesting is that this model is really no longer an academic discussion. The state of Texas is going to give this model a try. A pilot program in one Texas county is going to give this voucher model a try starting next year. So this podcast couldn't be more timely. We have two guest speakers today. Stephen Schulhofer is a professor of law at New York University and is one of the originators of the voucher proposal. Jim Bethke is executive director of the Texas Indigent Defense Commission, and he was intrigued enough by the voucher proposal to give it a try in this pilot program that I just mentioned. With respect to the format, we're going to give each speaker about 5 minutes to tell us more about this subject. After that, I'm going to ask a few questions that raise some of the objections we've heard from some of the skeptics who are aware of this proposal. Steve, why don't you go first and tell us more about the voucher proposal, how it would work, and why you think it would be better than what we're doing right now.
The Gideon decision, which was almost exactly 50 years ago, held that defendants have a right to appointed counsel at state expense. Before that, states sometimes did assign lawyers for the indigent, but the process was very haphazard. And the defendants had no clearly enforceable right to representation. So Gideon aimed to change that by establishing a clear constitutional right to effective assistance. I think it's interesting in background that Gideon is one of the most celebrated and uncontroversial decisions of the Warren Court. Almost nobody challenges the right to counsel in the way that other Warren Court decisions are so often attacked. But almost everybody who looks closely at criminal procedure on the ground agrees that in most jurisdictions, the way we provide defense counsel to the indigent is basically scandalous. Gideon allowed each county to decide for themselves how to implement the constitutional right. And almost all of them follow one of the two basic approaches that Tim just described. In the public defender model, the county government or the court system creates a public defender office, and the lawyers who work there, they usually work full time. They represent all indigent defendants. In the appointed counsel model, a judge or some other court official has a list of lawyers in private practice who take criminal cases, and then one of them will be appointed on a case-by-case basis for each criminal defendant. But what has happened is that in practice, both of these models have two fundamental flaws. The first one is that both of them depend on funding from state or local government, and the funding that government makes available almost always falls drastically short of what minimally adequate representation would require. For example, the acceptable caseload for a public defender is usually put at a maximum of about 100 to 150 felony cases per year, but public defenders are routinely assigned to more than twice that number, and caseloads of even 400 or 600 cases a year are not unheard of. The dynamic's a bit different in the case of assigned counsel because they're usually paid a stipulated fee either per case or per hour. But the compensation is almost invariably so low that they're forced to dispose of cases very, very quickly, usually on the basis of a negotiated plea, which they negotiate on the fly with very minimal preparation and minimal time to consult with the client. So the other flaw isn't just financial, but structural and fundamental, and that is that in both the assigned counsel and the public defender models, lawyers handling each case are inevitably affected by the priorities of the county government or the court system because those are the people who foot the bill. So the attorney lack of independence means that truly effective lawyering becomes a luxury, and even the best indigent defense lawyers have to ration their efforts among their clients rather than guarantee fully effective representation to every one of them. Of course, the lawyer has an ethical obligation to serve each individual client, but the clients don't automatically trust the lawyer who's assigned to them by the government. And all too often, this assembly line approach gives clients a pretty good reason to doubt the fairness of the entire system. So we have an obvious departure from the goals that Gideon aimed at. And apart from that, I think the current system undermines criminal justice much more broadly because it fundamentally weakens the adversary system, it increases the risks to the innocent, and it raises the rate of reversals on appeal. And probably the worst of all is that it promotes cynicism among indigent defendants themselves, which is hardly a recipe for creating respect for the law among the people who are most likely to pose a problem. So for more than 20 years, reformers have been trying to speaking about the crisis or the scandal in indigent defense representation. And the primary focus for all this period has been on pleading for more resources, and justifiably so, but there's been almost no success in getting cash-starved local governments to do anything about that. And there's been almost no effort to tackle the second problem, the lack of independence, which is probably the most peculiar feature of the current system, in that the indigent defendant is never permitted to select his own attorney. Defendants who aren't poor can choose, if the defendants who aren't poor can choose, as Tim mentioned, whichever lawyer they want. And our society would never tolerate a system in which a government bureaucrat would assign a lawyer to a middle-class person who is facing criminal charges. Likewise, I think our society would never tolerate a system in which a government bureaucrat would assign a doctor to people who need medical treatment. And that would be true whether they were paying for it themselves or whether they were senior citizens on Medicare. But we routinely impose a lawyer on the indigent in criminal cases. So the idea behind a voucher system, or we could call it a client choice model, is that the power to select the lawyer would be put in the hands of the person whose interests the lawyer is supposed to be representing. And in that respect, it's, as Tim mentioned as well, it's like a voucher system in other areas where people might prefer a private sector service provider to having those services provided directly by the government. In the same way, the client choice model would tap into private enterprise dynamics, which create incentives for effective service and customer satisfaction in the most efficient way. And it would automatically obliterate the conflicts of interest that now infect virtually every attorney-client relationship when the client is indigent, because the lawyers would know that their professional success depends on satisfying their client rather than just satisfying the court system that's hiring them. In the client choice model, by the way, I might add, there presumably still would be the list of lawyers who want to handle criminal cases, and public defender offices could still continue to operate. But at the outset of a case, each criminal defendant himself would pick the lawyer that he wants from that list rather than having a judge pick it. And each defendant could decide whether he likes the kinds of services that the public defender office provides or whether he'd rather prefer to pick a lawyer from the private bar. So the idea is that the client choice model would change the existing system only in a fairly simple way, at the point where that appointment decision is made, and it would move that power away from a court official and simply give it to the client. It's mechanically, it's a fairly simple step, but the hope is that this one step would give criminal defendants a way to avoid overextended public defenders, and they could avoid the kind of fly-by-night lawyers from the private bar that might be assigned to them. And at the same time, it would give those lawyers a strong material incentive, in addition to whatever their professional ideals might strongly motivate them, but it would give them a strong material incentive to satisfy their clients. And in that way, it could go a long way toward restoring the adversary system. We prize the adversary system. We talk all the time about how much we value it, but in practice in the criminal justice system today, what we have is a very thin facsimile of our ideals.
This is Tim Lynch. Steve, thanks a lot for that background. We're now going to turn to Jim Bethke of the Texas Indigent Defense Commission to tell us how he got interested in this idea and about the pilot program that's going to start next year. But Jim, I would like you to begin by telling us a little bit more about the Texas Indigent Defense Commission, the work it does, and the work you do there.
Very good. Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Steve. And thank you, the Federalist Society, for hosting this forum. In 1963, when the Gideon decision was decided, the state of Texas, I believe, since it was such an important right, basically placed full responsibility on local government. It wasn't until 38 years later that the state got involved with the creation of our organization, the Texas Indigent Defense Commission. At that point, we were called the Task Force on Indigent Defense. With the creation of our office, we were charged with providing some funding to local governments and to provide some oversight to local governments in carrying out its responsibilities to assign counsel to people too poor to pay. My commission is comprised of 13 members, 11 of which are elected officials. We have two statewide elected officials. As many on the call probably know, we have a bifurcated high court system with the Supreme Court and Court of Criminal Appeals. The two high court's judges serve on the commission along with members of the legislature. county government and a public defender and a defense lawyer. The commission sets the policy in which my staff and I carry out. A big responsibility of our organization, of course, is to provide funding to local governments. In order for the county to qualify for funding, it has to meet some certain basic requirements and be in compliance with any monitoring review that we've done. That money is through a formula, which is based on the population of the local jurisdiction as well as the expenditures. It's a 50-50 split. We also have another part of our funding strategy, and it's discretionary grants. And the purpose of the discretionary grants are to encourage local jurisdictions to explore new options in which to provide the services, and ideally a better way to provide those services, whether it's more cost effective, providing better services, getting counsel assigned quicker, or whatever it may be. So we have the two strategies. Most of the funding is distributed through the formula, but the discretionary grant program is what is used to really spawn innovation and really to promote better practices. About 4 years ago, in the fall of 2010, I received from Mark Levin with the Texas Public Policy Foundation an email that actually had Professor Showalter and David Friedman's article on reforming indigent defense and how the free market principles can help fix a broken system. I read it and immediately passed it on to the commission's chair, the Honorable Sharon Keller, and also the presiding judge of the Court of Criminal Appeals. She too liked the article. Shortly thereafter, we convened a meeting with Mark Levin and Vikrant Reddy, who I believe at that time may have been serving as a research assistant for the Cato Institute. Judge Keller and I explained how our discretionary grant program works and that we thought there was a good chance one of Texas's 254 counties might be interested in piloting a program of this nature. We also indicated, because of other pressing demands, we would not be able to undertake this initiative in the immediate future. That said, we indicated when an opportunity presented itself, we'd very much like to collaborate with the Texas Public Policy Foundation, the Cato Institute, and others to test pilot such a program. In addition to my work with the commission, I also serve on the Indigent Defense Advisory Group of the American Bar Association. The chair of the Indigent Defense Advisory Group at that time was Norman Lefstein, professor at law, and Dean Emeritus of the Indiana University Robert H. McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis. Dean Lefstein is one of the nation's foremost experts on indigent defense, and like Professor Showalter, is a thought leader in the area of client choice. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, I believe Dean Lefstein and Professor Showalter are the only two scholars in the nation to have studied and written on the topic of client choice. Short quote, Dean Lefstein in his recent book on excessive public defense caseloads, which Professor Showalter had alluded to, published by the American Bar Association, explains the potential benefits. To incentivize lawyers to control their caseloads and to ensure client interests are always paramount, another indigent defense reform should be considered. Enable the free market to function and permit clients to select their own lawyers, much as we permit patients with Medicare to select their own doctors. Although the practice makes enormous good sense and is used successfully with indigent legal services in other countries, it has never been seriously considered as a way to reform indigent defense in the United States. Given the persistence of excessive caseloads, this approach should be implemented, at least on an experimental basis, and if successful, much more broadly. In the fall of 2013, 50 years after the historic decision in Gideon, 3 years after the email I received from Mark Levin, and after extensive conversations with Dean Lefstein and Professor Showalter and many others, the Texas Indigent Defense Commission approved a discretionary grant to Comal County to test the concept of client choice. Comal County has a population of about 120,000 people and is located between Austin and San Antonio. Comal County, like most Texas counties, operates a traditional assigned counsel program. Generally speaking, this system works to provide counsel to the indigent. The system in place in Comal meets the basic requirements of the law, but like with all assigned counsel programs, there were some shortcomings. For example, incentives for attorney performance were wanting. There was minimal accountability regarding the services provided. And the system, as Professor Schoelhofer, lacked independence from the judiciary. So in October of 2013, a discretionary grant was awarded to Comal County. The program was designed really with three primary objectives. First, to better align attorney incentives with that of his or her client. Next, enhance the independence of the defense function from the judiciary. And third, introduce a new element of accountability through the marketplace. After the grant was awarded, we formed really kind of a core project team, which consisted of Dean Lefstein and Professor Schoelhofer, members of Comal County Judiciary, members of the local bar. We also had really extensive talks with the elected DA in Comal County, who was a strong supporter of the program and had read Professors Schoelhofer and Friedman's article. And we formed the core project team. We also expanded and formed a broader advisory group with folks that arguably we thought would be interested and could provide guidance, including the State Bar of Texas, the local Texas Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, some prominent defense lawyers across Texas. We also invited the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers to join, the General Counsel for the Governor's Office, and others. So the project is about to go live middle of next month. Extensive work has been done over the last year to actually put this in place. And I know the people in Comal County are excited about this to take off, as our core project team is. And I really feel extremely fortunate to have had the guidance of Dean Lefstein, Professor Schoelhofer, and the Justice Management Institute, who has been, we've contracted with to do the research side of it. It literally is a blue ribbon panel of folks that really get it. So we're looking forward to the project beginning next month.
Okay, Jim, thank you for that background information. What I'd like to do now is ask both you and Steve a few questions, kind of posing as a skeptic, raise some of the objections that have been raised against client choice. And then we'll move ahead and take some questions from the Federalist Society members who are sending their questions in. Steve, let me start with you. One thing we hear over and over again is that this is kind of perceived as an attack on public defenders, and someone will often say to me that public defenders get a bad rap. My experience with public defenders is that they're very good, very aggressive, they know the law, and so why move away from that model with this client choice voucher idea?
Yes, that's a very important question. I think there are a couple of reasons. I think it's important to be clear that our approach is not in any way a criticism of the integrity or professional competence of public defenders. They're usually, almost invariably, very dedicated, very idealistic, and they're working under very difficult circumstances. Their pay is almost invariably much lower, a small fraction of what they could earn in the private market, and they're working under difficult conditions because of their ideological commitment to preserving an adversary system. But that said, their skills are called upon to try to make the best of a very bad situation. They're usually very overloaded. And so it takes all the skill in the world to try to manage a caseload of 300 or 350 cases a year and to do the best that you can for a client under those difficult circumstances. So our criticism, our concern really focuses on a couple of aspects of this problem. One is that no matter how good the public defender is, the client doesn't necessarily know how good the public defender is. All that the client knows is that the court has imposed this lawyer on him. So he hasn't chosen, and he often feels that he's just being processed by the criminal justice system. There was a famous article on this subject where some sociologists asked defendants a series of questions, and they asked them, were you represented by a lawyer when you went to court? And the inmate responded, no, I was represented by a public defender. She reflected his idea that he was being processed by court officials and not by a real lawyer. So you have a problem of perception and a serious problem of trust or mistrust between lawyer and client. And that in itself is very bad for our system. Whether it has any factual basis or not, it's bad for the legitimacy of our system, and it's bad for the appearance of justice. And we know that the appearance of justice has a huge impact on obedience to the law and the general sense of legitimacy of authority in our country. So that's number one. Number two, it has concrete implications for the effectiveness of the attorney-client relationship, because if there's mistrust, then the client doesn't open up to the lawyer, or it may take a long time and a lot of effort, some of which the attorney just won't have time to put in order to establish that relationship of trust. And if a lawyer and client mistrust each other, they're not going to be able to get to the bottom of the case and put on a genuine defense. And then the third thing is that the system, as it stands, perpetuates the gross inadequacy of resources, because clients have no way to avoid these public defenders that are overburdened. And typically, the public defender is assigned to, is required to accept every case that the court sends to him. So even with the very best lawyers, they have no way to get themselves out from under what can be crushing caseloads. There has been litigation where public defenders sometimes go to court and ask the judges to excuse them from accepting further appointments. And usually, though, they lose those cases. Usually the courts say, you have to take every case we assign to you. So client choice would be a way. And to reiterate, to go back directly to your fundamental problem, none of this suggests that public defenders are not extremely skillful and extremely dedicated, but it's a way of addressing problems of mistrust and addressing the overly burdensome caseloads that they're required to hire to support. And when, to the extent that public defenders continue to perform effectively in a choice system, clients will choose them, and there should not be any problem, but it will avoid this basic lack of independence which taints so much of our system.
Okay. One other objection, Steve, that we hear, and we kind of have seen this in the school voucher debate as well, is that the people given the voucher are really not positioned well to make informed choices about what they should do. And so these indigent persons who are arrested, they don't know what what makes a good criminal defense attorney, and they're going to be bamboozled by big billboards with 1-800 numbers and maybe some misleading commercials. And the argument that I've heard is that these are people that make poor choices to begin with. That's why they find themselves in the criminal justice system, and they're really poorly positioned to make good decisions about who should be representing them in court. How would you respond to that?
That's a complicated argument and a complicated concern. I think there's certainly an element that all of us make poor choices from time to time. And there may be some sense that maybe people caught up in the criminal justice system are more likely to do that than others. But just to start with the basics, I think our entire economic system is based on the premise that consumer sovereignty, whatever its flaws may be, it's way ahead of the alternatives. And the idea of having some bureaucrat make choices for us is anathema to American society, and I think for very good reason. We could make exactly the same argument with respect to medical care. Many of us don't know who is the best surgeon, who is the best oncologist, and the rest of it. And many of us can be bamboozled or influenced by ads that we hear on the radio. More and more we're hearing ads for this hospital or that hospital. We may not make the best choices, but the notion that some bureaucrat can make that choice better for us is clearly not, it's that argument is really comparing the imperfections of a real world complicated system with the perfections of some imagined system. But any bureaucrat who's making these choices for us will have different reasons for making potential mistakes. And it's particularly bad when the person making the choice for us has conflicts of interest. And this is what actually makes our current system of indigent defense far worse than the system we would have, for example, in healthcare. Because the person who's appointing the lawyer is the judge or the county government, the very people that are essentially the county government is prosecuting the defendant, the judge is resolving the case. All of them have interests in picking a lawyer who's going to be less confrontational, more cooperative, less adversarial. So in all these respects, I think any theoretical notion that somebody might not make a perfect choice, it really disregards the realities of this. And it's also true that I think indigent people, first of all, the defendant may not be guilty. And I think the notion that these people make poor choices is based on the assumption that they committed the crime, which is the very thing we're trying to figure out. What we do know for sure is that they're poor. And if you think that people are poor because they make poor choices, that would play a role here. But I think we know enough about unemployment and things like that to realize that poor choices are not the only reason why people are in economic distress. And people in these situations may have better information than many of us. I think I shudder to think if one of the children one of the friends of one of my children was accused of a very serious crime, and I was asked, and I'm a criminal defense teacher, if I was asked who should represent him, I'm not sure I would really have the best on-the-ground picture of who the good lawyers were in a particular town. People who are in jail awaiting trial really have their ear to the ground for some remarkable intelligence. So all things considered, I think that the gains that we realize from consumer sovereignty and consumer choice are just so far outweigh beyond any question any imperfections that you could point to.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to ask Jim skeptical questions that we've heard regarding like the administration of such a program. One thing I bet judges are concerned about is that when a hearing is scheduled, the indigent defense person will show up and just say something like, "I lost my voucher," or "No one will accept my voucher," and kind of like throw some sand into an otherwise smoothly functioning system. You've heard that already, haven't you, Jim?
Yes, I've heard issues about the administration of kind of the justice and, you know, kind of shoddy performance. The good thing about that is there will be specific deadlines upon which and written out in the plan by which what time the attorney has to submit his or her voucher. And so the judiciary has constructed a set of plans as required by state law on how they're going to provide these services. And one of the reasons we had actually thought that this may become operational this year, it was a little tricky in drafting some of the local procedures to really kind of address some of these types of the issues that you've just raised, Tim.
Okay, and you mentioned that Comal County was an assigned counsel jurisdiction. Is the pay scale going to be the same with the client choice? Like, is it, if it was an hourly rate, is that going to stay the same, or if it was per case, will that stay the same, or what will any differences be?
Very good question, Tim. The members of the judiciary and county discussed this issue. And part of the thinking was that they were going to keep the current pay schedule in place. And like many of the Texas counties, they have kind of a two-part payment schedule. They have a hourly rate for in-court time and hourly rate for out-of-court time. And then they also have some kind of flat fees based on, you know, certain actions that have taken place. So the payment structure was left in place, basically no more money going in into it. And so that's one of the policy decisions that they had chosen to basically keep the pay structure the same.
I see. Okay. Christian, I think we're ready to take some questions from listeners.
All right. Well, we'll now open the floor to your questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. So if you'd like to ask a question of one of our experts, star and then the pound key. We didn't have anybody jump on right away. Maybe Tim is. Do you have any other questions you could ask while our audience is taking a minute to think of anything?
Certainly. Let me go back to Steve. Another objection that we frequently hear is that, you know, whether it's a public defender model or this client choice, the key issue is overall funding for indigent defense, and if that is lacking, it won't matter which model we're talking about. And some people are saying that's the key issue, not public defender versus client choice. How would you respond to that?
Yes, I agree that funding is a very important issue. And lack of funding is one of the things that stands in the way of effective assistance for the most dedicated and competent and the most idealistic lawyers. Many of them would love to do more for their clients, but they simply can't. So more funding would do a lot to solve that problem. But as long as the structure of the system skews the incentives of the lawyers who are involved, and as long as it interferes with their independence, more funding actually could do more harm than good, because with more in a lot of jurisdictions, what happens is that the judges are not appointing the very best lawyers. The judges are appointing lawyers who serve their judicial interests. It could be, for example, that the judge doesn't like lawyers who file a lot of motions. It could be that the judge prefers to appoint lawyers who, in turn, will make contributions to his campaign for re-election. And so the more that you have generous funding in a system where the appointment power is perverse in these ways, the more that you have generous funding, the more you're actually going to aggravate these kinds of distortions. So that's one problem. More funding may go in the wrong direction if the people who are appointing counsel don't have the client's interests primarily in mind. The second problem is that in the absence of more funding, some of these other problems we've talked about won't get solved. But a client choice system could be very helpful in bringing it home to people why more funding is needed. For example, you have many public defenders where the caseloads are 400, 450 cases a year. If clients start to shun those public defenders and pick private lawyers instead, the county will quickly discover that its costs per case are starting to rise because public defenders are more efficient than individual lawyers appointed case by case. So the county itself will then have an incentive to make the public defender a more attractive choice for clients. So that will create incentives that don't exist now. The only incentive we have now for a county to provide more generous funding is articles in the newspaper and people who are wringing their hands about innocent people being exonerated after years in prison and many of the other injustices that we read about. But at the end of the day, the county has to decide on its tax structure. And if we know from the past 25 years of experience that reform advocacy has not been persuasive. So number one, a choice system will in itself create incentives for the counties to afford more funding. And if they don't put up more funding, I guess we have three possible responses to this concern. One is that it will create incentives for them to afford more funding. Number two, in the worst case scenario where they can't, for whatever reason, can't or won't provide more funding, at least at the same level of funding, clients will have more sense of control over their own fate. And that in itself is important. And then the third reason is that if we do have more funding, we don't want the funds to be misused in the ways that they can be now.
Okay, thank you. Let me go back to Jim and ask another administration-type question. Let's say, Jim, that an attorney is in criminal defense practice in Como County and he's been accepting vouchers and things have been going well. Does he have to accept every person with a voucher that contacts him, or can he pick and choose and decline clients depending on his caseload or other factors if he just perceives like a personality conflict with a particular client that shows up at his office with a voucher?
Great question, and this is something that the project team and the locals addressed at length. And the lawyer has the absolute right to refuse a case because of overload and declare him or herself unavailable. I think Steve rightly points out the folks in the jail are going to know the lawyers in the local. There's a possibility that they're going to have some good intel on what lawyers perform. And Comal County was kind of picked because of its size and because of it. You know, if you go with a very large jurisdiction, there's a lesser likelihood sometimes that folks are really going to know who are providing these various professional services. But there's about probably 60 or so lawyers in Comal that provide criminal defense services. So if somebody's, you know, had a very successful case, it's in the paper, and everybody winds up going to that particular attorney, that attorney can say, no, I need to go ahead and declare myself unavailable. On the other side, for the logistics of it, we wound up basically saying, if you want to participate to the lawyer in this, you're going to have to accept the case if you're not declaring yourself unavailable because of workload or some other issue. And that was a logistical issue and something that, you know, we're going to monitor to see what impact, if any, that does have.
Okay, thanks. And you mentioned the size of the county. Can you give the listeners a better sense as to its size? Like, give us a general idea of, like, how many felony cases were processed through the county, let's say, in whatever year, you know, a recent year, like 2013 or 2012?
Yes. Matter of fact, the new reports from all Texas counties was due our office on November 1. Staff has compiled and has gotten that information. So in 2014, there were 542 new felony cases coming into the system. Out of those, 474 persons received counsel with an appointment rate on the felony side close to 90%. It was actually 87%. They spent in total on felony just over $400,000. In the misdemeanor in the county courts at law, there's two. There were just under 1,900 new filings. Approximately just over 700 persons received court-appointed counsel, just slightly under 40% of the persons coming into the system for charged with misdemeanors, and again, A or B misdemeanors, ones that have the potential of jail, not the non-jailable Class C offenses. And in total, Comal County spent $632,000 on indigent defense fees, of which that money was probably about 90%, just under 90% attorney fees. The rest was for investigators or experts.
Okay, thank you. Let's check back with Christian to see if we have some questions that have come in.
Well, Tim, we actually don't. Our speakers must have done a good enough job covering everything so far, but we've got, you know, about 9 minutes left. So if there's anything else, Tim, that you'd like to have the panelists discuss, we've still got a few minutes left.
Okay, sure. Let me go back to Steve and go back. I'm kind of going through the list of concerns or objections that I've heard since this proposal has started getting some publicity. And one of them is that if attorneys are paid according to vouchers, they are not going to fight hard for, like, suppression motions, and aren't they going to have a financial incentive to advise their clients, you know, push them in the direction of a quick plea deal instead of fighting for suppression motions that will, you know, make the case last longer. And the idea is that they'll have a financial incentive to resolve the case quickly so that they can move on to the next person with a voucher and that sort of thing. Whereas a public defender would be fighting hard for these suppression motions and that sort of thing.
Yes, that's a very interesting question. And I think it really raises the core of it is more focusing on how the lawyer's compensation is determined rather than who hires the lawyer. I think it's true that, for example, if the lawyer is paid a flat fee for every case, then he has an incentive to turn the case over quickly. Whereas if he's paid by the hour, he may even have an incentive to make the case last longer. At least if the hourly compensation is generous. And if a public, if the lawyer is working in a public defender's office, his financial incentives are fixed by his annual salary. So his only incentive might be his own self-esteem in doing the best possible job that he can do. So we can change those incentives by changing the structure of the compensation system. And client choice is a separate issue from that. Client choice is basically to say that however you want to resolve that question, however you want to decide to pay your lawyers, let the person who selects the lawyer make the decision about which lawyer he wants to pick, and that might even be which compensation system he prefers. One way to think about this, and it's very complicated. The question that you raise about how should a lawyer be compensated, that's very complicated if you try to play out the economic incentives on a flat fee per hour or annual salary framework on an issue like motion to suppress. One way to think about it would be to think about how we approach medical services. Some people would prefer to be in an HMO. Some people would prefer to have a point of service or preferred provider system where you pick your own doctor in each instance. And there are advantages and disadvantages to the HMO system compared to a system of individual specialists. But I don't think we'd say that's a reason for forcing people into one system or another. I think it's an even stronger reason for letting people choose. And one illustration of that is something that Norman Lefstein found. Jim has talked about Norman's important role in this. And when Norman did research on this problem in other countries, one thing he found was that client choice is universally accepted as the normal and sort of obvious approach in other countries that we consider similar to our own, like England, Scotland, Canada. They take it for granted that an indigent should be able to choose his own lawyer in the same way that a person of means could do. And when in Edinburgh, Scotland, when they created a public defender, they initially started assigning defendants to the public defender without giving them a choice. And after a short period of time, the chief public defender in Edinburgh went back to the court and he said, this is a terrible system because clients feel that we're being inflicted on them. He said, we can do a terrific job for these clients, but they will learn that themselves and let them feel that they're choosing us. So that's what I would fundamentally come back to, that the best way to guarantee that the lawyer's incentives are aligned with the person he's supposed to be representing is to let that person, the client, pick. And the client then controls the fund, the business, and the revenue and the professional success of the lawyer.
Okay, thank you. Let me go back to Jim Bethke. And I know one of the questions that will come up a year or two from now is the client choice pilot program, has it been a success? We got to compare it to the models that are in place in other jurisdictions. And I know you've begun to wrestle with what are going to be the metrics as far as, you know, determining whether or not the pilot program is successful or not. Can you talk a little bit about that? How are we going to be able to determine if it's a success?
Tim, great question, and real pleased to report that there has been a baseline assessment conducted already by the Justice Management Institute to know where we began at, and some of the metrics will include, but will not be limited to these, but just these are some of the examples: the number of defendants advised of their right to select their own lawyer, the number of defendants who select their own attorney, the number of defendants who request an attorney appointment the timing of the first attorney-client meetings, because the contact with the client is a critical element, and it's a complaint that I hear from other jurisdictions where the lawyers aren't meeting with their clients on a regular basis. And we're hoping with when someone is picking you to represent them that there's going to be a greater incentive by the lawyer to meet with his or her client. And one of the other things we're going to look at too is attorney attrition. There's always the possibility that it sounds good, but attorneys are going to be forced to, you know, stay in if they decide not to. And I think what kind of the broader audience will be interested is the outcome evaluation will focus on the impact at really kind of three different levels. And Professor Schoenhofer discussed this some already, but the defendant level of satisfaction and trust, case level outcomes, and then really the part that I'm interested in those, but we're also interested in system level impact on attorney performance, the courts, the cost, the system overall. Funding is absolutely critical, and we're seeing if really introducing choice into the marketplace with the person who has the most to lose, if it has an impact. And that is going to be something that's rigorously tested. And so that'll be forthcoming in, you know, probably 18 months or 24 months.
Okay, that's excellent. Thank you, Jim. I think we have covered a lot of ground in this podcast. Let me just say to anyone who's listening and is interested in learning more about this subject, they can download a paper about client choice from the Cato Institute website or just Google Reforming Indigent Defense. Our guest speakers have alluded to this paper earlier in the podcast, and that paper can be downloaded for free and you can get more information about it. Christian, I think we're about ready to wrap this up then.
Fantastic. Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Tim Lynch for moderating today's call. Thank both of our experts as well. Thank you to our audience for joining us. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. A reminder that you can find this call is posted as a podcast, as well as the recordings of all of our other previous Teleform conference calls at our website at www.fedsoc.org. So until next time, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.